If I told you that the subject of today's program is a man who ploughs his land with horses, you might think we're entering the world of fantasy. But Wendell Berry has his feet planted firmly in the soil of Kentucky, where his family have lived since the early 1800s. Here he pursues what he calls an ethic and way of life based upon devotion to a place and devotion to the land. He's been writing about farming and its place in society for 4 decades. He has taught creative writing, written poetry and novels, and campaigned in the cause of sustainable agriculture. Berry doesn't claim to have all the answers to the problems of our technology-driven economy, but he is committed to a simple life. Humans, he says, must live in harmony with nature or perish. Gene Snediger has been to Henry County, Kentucky, to meet him.
A beautiful, is that a bluebird or?
That's an indigo bunting. He's a beauty, isn't he?
Isn't he a beauty?
He thinks so too.
I agree with him.
Some bright morning when this life is over, I'll find a way.
Wow, nice big black barn.
Framed in timbers, the oldest ones are hand hewn.
This is your horse-powered mowing machine.
That's right. And they're really good pieces of equipment. Cutting-edge horse technology there.
Ah, fantastic vegetable garden here.
Lettuce, beets, carrots.
Broccoli.
Onions, broccoli.
Can you feed yourself and Tanya and the family pretty much from this vegetable garden?
Pretty much. We grow the major part of what we eat, although we're not fanatics. Tanya shops for stuff. She drinks coffee. We eat bananas. This is 2 varieties of sweet corn.
Which varieties do you grow?
This is candy corn, and I think that down there may be Silver Queen.
I love Silver Queen.
Yeah, I do too. It's pretty, for one thing.
And it tastes good.
It tastes good. I've seen my work as an essayist, as a writer about agriculture, as understanding and articulating the best I can the real complexity of the issues. I think the result of the industrialization of agriculture, or one of them, is a radical oversimplification of the issues of food production. And I've tried to say, wait a minute, in talking about good farming, you can't talk just about agriculture. You can't talk just about agronomy. You can't talk just about vegetables or animals. You've got to talk about people. You've got to talk about the local ecosystem, the local history, the local hopes and aspirations. All these things have to be considered.
Even though Wendell Berry writes about Kentucky and very local issues around his farm, the way he writes is admired even here. I'm standing outside Millbank, opposite the Houses of Parliament, and about to speak to the BBC's political editor, Andrew Marr.
If you think of the fantastically large numbers of people who not only have written but made their living by writing, and the tiny number of those who actually survive as living red writers, that leads you to begin to understand just how difficult it is to write well. It's not enough to write honestly. It's not enough to study other people who write well. It's not enough to write in your own speaking voice, though those are all parts of what is essential. Even beyond that, there is an indefinable clarity and excitement about great writing, which is so rare. How many people are there alive on the planet today? You know, 6.7 billion? I don't know. Now, there are probably 2 or 3 of them writing in English who are this good, and Wendell Berry is one, and he is as good as Defoe, and he is as good as George Orwell, and he's as good as Hazlitt. He is the best of what we do. That is not to say that I agree with him on everything. I don't agree with him about lots of things. I bitterly don't agree with him about aspects of globalization. I certainly don't agree with him about religion. But he has a voice. He has a voice that very, very few people on this planet do.
He's a very local person. He writes things about his own world. What influence do you think he could or should or does have on Britain today?
He's got lots of ways back into Britain. He writes about our writers. He writes about agriculture and the countryside. He writes about really the most important things. There was a report out recently, like many others, arguing in detail that if we are going to all be living at the same standard as the richest nations in this on the planet today, we are going to need several extra Earths. We are not going to get several extra Earths. We have the one we've got, and we either use it better and live better and think differently, or we are all in terrible trouble. Now, I think that is the biggest political message, not just for people of this generation, but the next and the next and the next. Now, if I'm right, then Wendell Berry is the most popular and comprehensible prophet of all of this.
Because Wendell Berry himself says that the one group that probably exemplifies some of the things that he says are the Amish. And yet it's very difficult to imagine that that kind of community could be big beyond the Amish of Pennsylvania or wherever.
He is an extremist. He is an avowed extremist. And we are not going to live that way, and we are not going to be that way. But if you don't have the big black and white kind of crimson and gold-flecked prophets, then you don't have any movement at all.
Love the quick profit, the annual raise, vacation with pay, want more of everything ready-made. Be afraid to know your neighbours and to die, and you will have a window in your head. Not even your future will be a mystery any more. Your mind will be punched in a card and shut away in a little drawer. When they want you to buy something, they will call you. When they want you to die for profit, they will let you know. So, friends, every day do something that won't compute. Love the Lord. Love the world. Work for nothing. Take all that you have and be poor. Love someone who does not deserve it. Denounce the government.
When I was growing up here, this country was pretty well settled, really stable in its population in comparison to what it is now. The field work was still being done with the horses and mules and human labor. It never occurred to me that we wouldn't go on farming here forever the way we were farming then.
But it changed.
In the 50s, mechanization came so that the farmer's dependence on supplies, fuel, fertilizer, and chemicals increased significantly. This worked against the economic self-sufficiency of the farm families. Debt increased. The idea grew upon us that it was better to work indoors than out. It was better to work sitting down than standing up. There was a prestige that attached to city jobs that didn't attach to farm work. So there's a whole system, you might say, of causes that account for what happened here.
Well, here's your tractor power, Wendell.
Here's mine.
One, two, three, four.
They're five.
Five big horses.
These two are three-year-olds. This is Jed, and that's Nip over there. They're my team. And I must say, they're good. He'll be a white horse eventually.
Like me.
That's right. Start out black and turn white.
How long does it take you to mow this hillside?
Probably 8 hours.
That's pretty fast.
Well, it would be much faster, but I have all those trees down there to mow around.
What do your neighbors think of you mowing with horses in this day and age?
Oh, some of them think it's fine. I'm sure some of them think I'm crazy. I don't ask. Not a great many people aspire to farm the way I do.
Now, you were greatly inspired by growing up here in terms of almost everything. You started writing professionally and teaching, and you left for some time.
I left thinking that I would become a writer, and that I would always live away. in other places. However, my father had very consciously raised me as an agrarian and a farmer because he understood the land-based values as fundamental to everything. And I can't imagine what my life would have been like if I hadn't come home. All I can say is that I'm glad I did. We've seen our grandchildren grow up, the ones who've grown up, and we intend to see the rest grow up if the Lord spares us.
And little Marshall, I think, is going to be helping you with the manure tomorrow morning.
That's right. He's very much attracted to helping me clean my barns this summer. We've been having quite a time.
So, werte Frau, ich regalte dir.
Ziemlich.
Ziemlich, was ist los?
Aus.
My name is Bruce Bettler, and I grew up here in Helvetia, West Virginia, and then moved away for many years and have come back here to be the cheesemaker. I realized that Helvetia, West Virginia, this little Swiss village I'm from, has an amazing effect on people. Those of us who live here understand that that's a fast-dying thing unless some kind of economic revitalization occurs. And in deciding to move back here, I read this fascinating book by Wendell Berry. He said that some of the woes that we're experiencing in our country are the rural flight. As people leave the farms and go into the cities, there becomes an unbalance in the way our society is. And I realized that coming back here could be important to, not the whole world necessarily, but to my corner of civilization. And that's why I've come back. Let me show you the cheese house. It was built in the 1840s. As you can see, the bottoms of the boards on the outside are starting to crumble in. The doors are still fairly sound.
Yeah.
Back here in the curing room, it's like a cave back in here.
Yeah, it is.
I have to replumb these sinks and rescrub shelves, and then we should have a functional cheese house.
Now, I notice you have Olga out here, your new cow. Is she the first Helvetia cheese producer?
I hope so. I was at the stockyards yesterday taking the sheep in and asked the guy, are there any milk cows here? And he said, there's that Guernsey. And I looked at her, and she led around so nicely and held still to be milked, and she was mine.
So what kind of cheese are you going to make?
Helvetia cheese, which we have produced since the 1870s. It's a Bergkäse, or mountain cheese, which means it's made from raw milk, and the culture exists naturally in the air here, in the climate.
And the rain came down.
Amen. Yeah, this area gets the most precipitation east of the Mississippi, but as you can see, that's why it's so lush and green. Should be great for dairy cows, right?
Absolutely. Olga's happy out there.
Barry is pointing out in his book, and we're discovering here in Helvetia, that the country has been wound tighter and tighter like a clock. I have friends who are working in the D.C. area who are scheduled back-to-back every hour of their life. Yeah, here it's the opposite.
Only a healthy local economy can keep nature and work together in the consciousness of the community. Only such a community can restore history to economics.
Why is local so important to you?
If the fuel economy becomes appropriately expensive, we're going to find that local food is the cheapest. Local food, if it's produced by truly locally adapted agriculture, is the best assurance of genetic and varietal diversity. But local food also is going to be the food that's most under the influence of consumers. Here in our own community, if urban consumers want to, they can, in effect, order their food custom grown from local producers. In other words, a local food economy has in it the promise of a kind of cooperation.
It seems that it has been just accepted wisdom that economies of scale make it better. You know, bigger is better.
The principle of economic competition, principle of the free market, are fundamentally alien to the nature of agriculture and farming. You can't, in my opinion, justify allowing the market to destroy local production capacities for essential goods. I don't think it would ever be justified to permit an area's capacity to produce food to be destroyed simply because some other place in the world is able to produce it cheaper.
Hi, how's it going?
Well, thank you.
Been busy?
Yes.
Good sustainable fish made into fish cakes, locally caught. I'm Henriette Green, and I run Food Lovers Fairs, Food Lovers Markets, have a website, foodloversbritain.com. And when I first read Wendell Berry, it just made so much sense. It's talking about how the producer has to fit into his economy and to increase his own trade within it. For example, Peter Clark of Kingcup Farm. When I first met Peter, he had a pick-your-own farm. And, I mean, Peter, tell us about it. It was kind of like doing okay, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, indeed. In the 80s and early 90s, pick-your-own did very well indeed. But the market has changed over the years now, and we've had to move with it, of course. And now farmers' markets are definitely the thing to be in, and it seems to be what the customers are looking for.
And what real difference has that made to your income, to your livelihood?
Well, it's ensured the survival of our small family business.
And it's amazing the range that you've got here today. I mean, here we are, broad beans, wonderful bunch of carrots in all different colours, the yellow carrots, and then a range of the soft fruits, the black currants, the gooseberries, edible flowers. It works locally because you can't transport them, they don't last, and that gives you a sense of added value. Peter, were you ever tempted to give up growing on the kind of scale that you were, the whole variety, and just think, OK, I'll be a monoculture, I'll just grow one vegetable big time and start supplying the supermarkets?
I personally wouldn't want to do that. First of all, I think it would be rather boring just to grow cabbages or something like that. And secondly, I don't want a large-scale business.
Why?
Well, I think I would end up working for my staff and the bank, whereas this way we work for ourselves.
And is it important for you to remain rooted within your local economy?
Oh, certainly, yes. I'm getting old now, and you realise that you're not going to be chairman of ICI or prime minister, and so it's nice to be able to contribute something in the community and do something interesting at the same time.
The loss of the tobacco crop, or the drastic reduction of it, has put us under heavy pressure to develop a local food economy. What we're doing, with some small success, is turning to our urban neighbors and saying, look, we have this to offer. That is a local supply of food that can be produced to your order. Do you want to help us? And some of them do.
One of the primary results and one of the primary needs of industrialism is the separation of people and places and products from their histories. This is an economy and, in fact, a culture of the one-night stand. I had a good time, says the industrial lover, but don't ask me my last name. Just so, the industrial eater says to the svelte industrial hog, we'll be together at breakfast. I don't want to see you before then, and I won't care to remember you afterwards.
You have campaigned long and hard, at least in your writings, against industrial agriculture, big agribusinesses. Why have you fought so hard against that?
Because it's destructive. The problem with industrial agriculture is that it makes the industrial means the measure of the farm or the farming. If you want to have a healthy farm, you have to go by the measure of nature, and you have to imitate the natural processes.
What, for example, have you done on the farm or changed since you've been back here as a result of observing the nature of this area?
What I've learned from being here on this very demanding, highly vulnerable land is the importance of keeping it covered, the importance of grass where you don't have trees, the importance of not subjecting the land to inordinate demands. I've learned, I think, to ask it what it can do rather than tell it what I think it ought to do.
In some ways, it sounds like you want to turn the clock back. You have said that you admire the Amish who live out a lot of the principles you advocate. Is it really possible to turn the clock back?
Oh, I venture to say that it isn't. I don't think that's what I'm advocating. In the first place, we haven't had a time in the past that solved all of the past problems. The lively and interesting question is whether or not we can be more intelligent about our life and our economy than we presently are being. The Amish use some old agricultural technology. If you were to go and visit certain Amish communities that I know, you would see that they're well farmed and that the age of the technology is really irrelevant. The question is whether the technology is achieving the desired end or not. What I recommend the Amish for is their willingness to ask a question that the rest of us simply haven't learned to ask, and that is, what will this do to our community? We don't ask that question because so far we think community disintegration is an acceptable trade-off for some kind of economic bonanza. We also think that air pollution, water pollution, soil erosion, and so on are acceptable trade-offs to achieve short-term glamorous economic aims. We're wrong about that, and the Amish are right. And the Amish have their survival as communities of people to show for it.
I'm Jeremy Rifkin. I'm president of the Foundation on Economic Trends in Washington, D.C. I would describe Wendell Berry as the most pressing example of our romantic tradition, in the best sense of that word. You know, for the last 200 years, there's been an ongoing struggle between the philosophy of the Enlightenment and those who have critiqued that philosophy, the Romantics and Neo-Romantic school. In a sense, what Wendell Berry has done is remind us of our traditions, our agrarian past. The interesting thing is, unlike some writers, he actually practices what he preaches.
What practical impact has he had on people, other than reminding them of their past?
He has been one of a handful of mentors here in the United States and around the world for a younger generation that's trying to get back to its roots. He's been a guide to a series of movements that began with the New Left in the 1960s, the Back to the Land movement of the 1970s, the Organic and Sustainable Agricultural movement of the 1980s, and the Anti-Globalist movement of the 1990s. He's been there at every step of the way, as a figure that the younger generation, now two generations of younger people, can look to for guidance.
What about the big guys in agribusiness? What do they think of?
I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think he's on their radar screen.
They don't even notice him?
No. He's not an activist in that sense. He's not out on the front lines on genetically modified crops. He is in the prophetic tradition. In a sense, what he's helped us do is bridge the gap between farming and environmental consciousness. For a long time, there was a rift between the farming community and the environmental community and the animal rights community. Wendell Berry has said to us this rift ought not to exist. So I think that in some way, he's allowed us to bring together the farming community, the environmental community, the organic and sustainable development communities, and the animal rights communities in more of a seamless web. I think that's an honorable legacy for any one human being to be able to claim.
Today is Sunday, And I know that often on Sunday mornings you actually go out and write poetry and have done for a long time.
Sometimes I do. Sometimes I go to church. But when I go out to wander on Sunday morning or to find a good place and sit, as the case may be, I don't go with the purpose of writing poetry. Poems come to me to be written sometimes, and then I do my best to write them and to write them as well as I can. Robert Frost said what he'd like a reader to get from a poem by him was a sense of what a hell of a good time he had writing it, and I think that's good criticism. That's what I'd like people to get from what I've written.
Some people think that you're way ahead of your time, that our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren in Britain and the rest of Europe will know your name far more than people do now. Do you think that's true?
I think that kind of question is a distraction. The debate will still be going on in a long time to come. That I might be associated with it is really of no interest to me. I'm very certain that the powerful people in agriculture and politics who might have had the power to change things before this have certainly ignored me and all my allies because they've had the luxury of doing it. They've had the power, they've had the wealth, they've had the dominant fashion of thought. However, I don't have the feeling that I've been ignored. Too much to the contrary, in fact. My work has had the good fortune of finding friends almost from the first. The friendships that my agricultural advocacy has led me into have been one of the great delights and good fortunes of my life, and the source of a lot of fun.
Gene Snediger in Kentucky with Wendell Berry. Next week, in the last program about people who've changed our attitude to food and eating, we'll be talking to design guru and restaurateur Sir Terence Conran.